The next case of the morning is number 06-1985, Maria L. Aguirre against Turner Construction. Mr. Lundblad.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel, my name is Milo Lundblad, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, the Aguirre family. Illinois has adopted Section 414 of the Restatement of Torts. Section 414 provides that a general contractor who retains control over any part of the work being done by a subcontractor owes a duty of care and can be held liable for unreasonable or for not fulfilling that duty. In this particular case, the trial court misapplied, in our view, the section to the facts of this case and reached the wrong conclusion. If one looks at Illinois case law on this topic, and there are many, many cases, it appears that each case appears to rise and fall on the particular facts of the case. For that reason, I believe that it's important to look at the facts involving Mr. Aguirre's accident. In this particular instance, Mr. Aguirre was working as a bricklayer. And when his company was, and this was at the Soldier Field renovation project, his company reached a portion of the work where they were going to be putting face bricks around a series of doorways that were underneath the north end zone at the stadium. Now, this architectural layout of these doorways presented peculiar problems to the bricklayers. They could not use normal scaffolding. It was not a flat wall that we'd have here where they could start at the bottom, put their scaffolds, and work their way up. Here, there were door openings, there were columns, there were beams that all created impediments to the normal use of scaffolding. The record shows that the people from All Masonry recognized that they could not use normal scaffolding, and more importantly, they did not believe that they could abide by the rules and regulations of defendant TBMK. TBMK had a very stringent safety program. They had 23 different rules and regulations that applied to scaffolding, and in particular, they required fall protection at a much lower height, 6 feet, rather than the 10-foot OSHA level. So the people from All Masonry, Mr. Cotton and their safety director, Lorna Zimar, went to TBMK, and they said, look, we have a problem. We can't use our normal scaffolding. How can we deal with it? And why did they go to TBMK? Why didn't they just work out the solution themselves and do it? Well, it's because of the contract. And under Illinois law, the several cases, including, I believe, the most recent one, Cochran, that provides, a very good discourse and discussion of the law, Cochran says the first thing you must look to are the contractual agreements. Did the contractor retain and reserve the power to direct the work? And if we look at the contract in this particular case, it's clear that TBMK retained its authority to enforce safety, to enforce scaffold rules, and it was in charge. In fact, TBMK reserved the right to fire individual employees of a subcontractor if it found that the employee violated rules and regulations.
Counsel, if I could interrupt for a minute. I have just a sort of threshold clarifying question to ask. Are you proceeding on a theory of vicarious liability for the negligence of the subcontractor, proceeding against this defendant, the general contractor, on that sort of a theory, or simply a theory of the general contractor's own negligence?
It's twofold, actually. Under Section 414, if the general contractor retains sufficient amount of control, then a vicarious liability will apply.
That's not what Section 414 says. I know that the Intermediate Court of Appeals in Illinois has used that terminology in the context of applying Section 414, but that can't possibly be right because the language of the restatement itself speaks to a species of direct negligence liability on the part of the general contractor when there is sufficient indicia of control factually. If you're pursuing a vicarious liability claim, you're under the principles of agency law, and the sentence in the commentary to the restatement, Section 414, simply refers the reader over to agency principles and the establishment of a master-servant relationship, which would give rise to vicarious liability. And it doesn't mean that Section 414 is a species of vicarious liability. It's not.
In this particular case, there's no need to go the vicarious liability route.
Well, that's why I'm trying to clarify whether that's one of your theories here. If it is, then you've got to talk about agency principles and whether this relationship, which is otherwise a relationship of a general contractor and an independent contractor where there would be no vicarious liability, you'd have to demonstrate that under agency law and the appropriate sections of the restatement of agency are met, or at least there's a fact in dispute about whether they would be met such that there would be a master-servant relationship that you could prove up at trial.
Right. In this particular case, maybe I misunderstood your question. In this particular case, we do not need the vicarious liability, that we are proceeding, although under both, but in this case, the facts indicate that there should be direct liability by TBMK. Because in this particular instance, when Mr. Cotton and Ms. Zimar went to TBMK and said, how are we going to solve this problem? It was TBMK who said, number one, you're going to use the lintel beam as a fall protection device. Number two, you're going to put a second scaffold in front of the first one to act as a catch. Number three, we're going to approve your way of putting in the scaffold so that you don't have cross braces between each frame.
And okay. I guess my question isn't being answered. I understand that you are pursuing a direct negligence claim against this defendant, the general contractor, based on its own involvement in controlling the safety conditions at this work site, as well as controlling the actions, or at least your position is that there are sufficient facts in dispute to warrant a trial on whether the general contractor had sufficient control over the actions of the subcontractor to be directly liable for its own negligence in failing to appropriately supervise or design the scaffolding. So that much I get. What I don't get is whether you are also attempting to prove up a vicarious liability claim. You're saying you don't need it. So are you abandoning it? Are you waiving
okay.
it?
No. Under Section 414...
That's not a vicarious liability section of the restatement. It's a direct liability species of tort. Vicarious liability is no fault, and you have to prove up an agency relationship.
Okay.
Section 414 is fault-based. You've got to prove up the negligence of the general contractor, if it applies.
I understand your question. And, yes, we are relying on 414, so we would not be relying on a strictly vicarious liability situation.
Thank
I apologize
you.
For not understanding your question directly. Under 414, however, in this particular circumstance, it was TBMK who dictated how the scaffold was to be built. And it's also our position that the defects that, in fact, caused the accident were design ideas that were implemented by TBMK. And I think the record shows, in particular a colloquy of John Cotton, that TBMK held the upper hand, that if TBMK said, you shall do this, John Cotton said, to the effect, if they wanted it, I did it. And it was...
How do we reconcile the facts on the ground as you are describing them about how this job site was operated from a safety standpoint and the contractual provision in the contract between the general contractor and the subcontractor imposing responsibility on the subcontractor for the safety of its own activities?
It's a mutual obligation. I think the case that addresses this is the Mustang Construction case because TBMK also had a contract with the developer. And the developer said to TBMK, and TBMK agreed, we will be responsible for all aspects of safety. And it was a very similar situation in the Mustang case. And the court in Mustang said, you can't contract away that obligation that you had with the developer. So it's a co-obligation, a co-duty. I mean, both the subcontractor and TBMK had safety responsibilities. And the fact that the subcontractor also agreed did not, under the law, relieve TBMK of its obligations and responsibilities. So it's a mutual obligation. So it's our position that under the facts of this case, the control that was exerted by TBMK, not both in reality through the meetings that it had, it designed or was a co-designer of the scaffold that failed, and also through its contracts, rules and regulations and safety manuals, which is another independent leg upon which liability can rest, we believe the summary judgment granted in this case must be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lundblad. We'll hear now from Mr. Knight.
May it please the Court, Counsel. I think right off the bat there's been a lot of talk about the scaffold in question, and for sure we know from the facts of this case that nothing in the scaffold failed. Nobody has any complaint about how the scaffolds were designed. What we do know was that shortly before this accident, the scaffold was put together by the employer, All Masonry, and Mr. Aguirre and his crew.
But didn't TBMK employees aid in formulating a design for the scaffold?
They did, Your Honor, and there is no evidence in this case that there was anything that was wrong with the design of it so far as it has to do with the accident. Counsel mentioned over and over criticism with, I guess, certain theoretical aspects of it, the cross-bracing. There's no evidence that the cross-bracing failed or caused the scaffold to fall. There's been some suggestion that because you may or may not be able to cross from one scaffold underneath the doorway to the other, that might be a problem, and I would agree with Your Honor, if that were the case, we might be in a different situation here, but there's no evidence that caused the plaintiff to fall.
Well, was it typical in the construction industry for contractors to issue programs, safety programs like this to the subs, when you had 23 rules regarding the design, construction, and use of scaffolds?
I don't know if it's typical, but the case law in Illinois as it's developed now with respect to comment C, and I may or may not get into that, allows contractors to do that. And as Judge Conlon pointed out, it would be curious to punish any general contractor for promulgating specific safety rules when the overall goal in any construction site is construction and safety for the employees.
It's not punishment to say that you're responsible for doing the job non-negligently.
I understand, and I think that in any construction site, general contractors hire subcontractors because of their particular skill and expertise. This is no different. And the only and if we can't do that, I don't know where it would be. In this particular Soldier Field project, for example, it was a huge project. There were 50 plus contractors, 1,200 workers. TBMK employed three basically safety people, which, you know, may or may not be more than other contractors do, but it was an attempt to make the job safe. But when the smoke clears, generals have to be able to trust the subcontractor to be able to employ their own methods, means of doing their specific work.
Well, and the restatement, Section 414, maintains that line of demarcation. It just imposes liability where the general contractor does undertake a sufficient level of supervisory authority, either contractually or as a matter of fact, and requires that supervisory authority, that retained control, be exercised or carried out in a non-negligent fashion.
I agree, and Judge Conlon relied upon those line of cases that rely upon comment C of the restatement, having to do with how the work was actually done. I don't think anybody's suggesting you never look to the contract to see what responsibilities there might be on a general contractor, but we know in this case the general never agreed to stand there and watch the All Masonry people put up the scaffold. It would be a useless gesture, and I think it'd be kind of silly for any general contractor to undertake that. It's not possible.
But it is a matter of the factual record in this case that your client signed off on the design of this particular scaffolding and superintended that process and also was actively involved in monitoring safety at the site on a daily basis.
True, and that's all true enough, but there wasn't anything about the design of this scaffolding that contributed to the plaintiff's accident.
That's a question of causation. The district court here granted summary judgment on the absence of a duty, and
right.
so we should probably stick to
And I should have restricted it to the duty to put up the scaffold like it was designed to do, to be put up. In this particular case, the evidence is that an hour or two before this accident, someone put planks on the top of the scaffolding, having nothing to do with any other design aspect. And for whatever reason, and despite some testimony from all masonry employees that said that they walked on this planking with no problem, somehow, unexpectedly, and I don't know if we're ever going to explain how it happened, the planking itself that was put up 2 hours earlier failed. It wasn't the design of the scaffold. It wasn't the plan of attack for putting scaffolds next to these doorways. It was all masonry who had five certified scaffold erectors who all said that, who never voiced any objection to the way it was done, and who weren't there when this exact scaffold was erected. There were other scaffolds that all masonry used on this project. There were, I think, according to the record, 100 different scaffolds on the project.
So you would acknowledge a duty would exist if there was a design flaw?
No, I wouldn't, because in this case, all masonry were experts in putting up their own scaffolds. And we never will answer the question about what if all masonry decided that they really couldn't safely have their people work on a scaffold that the general had quote, designed. I guess it's just not an issue in the case as far as the facts are concerned, my opinion. So what we have here, and Judge Conlon relied upon a line of cases that relies upon comments C of the restatement. I think comments A and B have to do with, well, a situation not connected with this case, but I don't think we have to look at those 15-plus cases that apply comment C like the district court did, as opposed to the three or four cases that look only to the contract to decide who has or who doesn't have a duty as to a construction site. I think constructive...
Why is it that you think that... comment A and B of the restatement do not apply, and the cases that apply it do not apply?
Because in this particular, for comments A and B, comment A and B have to do with those situations where the general contractor has agreed to supervise the work of the subcontractors. I don't know why anybody would do that, but that's what comments A and B, I think, say. The weight of authority, however, is certainly comment C, where we all have to look to the actual practice of the general and the subs to decide whether or not a duty would arise in the first instance.
Well, but when you look at these 23 rules, it's not just the construction of it, it's the use of them and the daily inspectors and the authority to stop the work and to issue fines and to terminate the sub. I mean, all of those factual matters really go to the issue of whether there's a duty. It's hard to imagine that this isn't a situation, given the level of oversight.
There wasn't one of those so-called rules that are ascribed to be the cause of this accident.
I understand that. Somebody, but the focus should be on the duty. And it may very well be, and since none of those rules are implicated, then there's no negligence. I mean, that may ultimately be what is determined in this case, but this did dictate the use of the scaffolds, and people were walking around to inspect to see if they were used properly and that kind of thing.
Right, and the contracts also clearly demarcated the responsibilities between the general and all masonry, who again were the experts at putting up scaffolds. They had five certified people, and they were the ones that were supposed to put it together, and apparently it didn't happen that way. It didn't happen correctly. So it's just a matter of, first of all, you know, acknowledging that in construction sites anywhere, you should be able to hire a competent subcontractor to do work, and for fear of imposing upon yourself a duty that you wouldn't otherwise have, you hold off on promulgating specific safety-related rules, again, for fear that you're going to be in a worse position than you would have been had you not signed the contract, in a worse position maybe than we were under the old Structural Work Act, which is not an issue here, but It's, I think, a clear indication in the weight of the case law. 15-some-odd cases support, including three from this district and one from this court, including the analysis under comment C rather than A or B. I think the district court opinion, you know, cited, I think it was the Martins case, it would be a curious state of affairs if you ask somebody to take care of safety, but at the same time, you know, if they go too far or say too much or get too involved in safety, you may find yourself in a position that that legally speaking that they, you know, they shouldn't have to be in.
Well, isn't this case very much like that Bacotti case, that Illinois appellate case, where in that case the defendant established their own safety program, they retained control over incidental aspects of the work, including 29 safety measures. They had a full-time safety manager who conducted weekly meetings, walked around the site, could halt the work. I mean, it almost is identical to the situation we have here in terms of the scope of involvement.
And for sure, Bacotti had that analysis, and it's one of four cases that follow that analysis. The rest of them look to see what was actually happening on the actual project to determine whether or not a duty would be owed in a given situation. I think Bacotti and the three cases that follow it pale by comparison to the others, but they concentrate on one issue of 414 analysis and ignore everything else. If there are no more questions, I appreciate the court's attention.
Thank you, Mr. Knight. Ms. Ludenbrock, I believe your time had expired, so we'll take the case under advisement. With our thanks to both counsel.